What characteristics do deep political events like 9/11 and the Kennedy assassination have in common? Does the recent Ottawa shooting constitute a deep event? How have such events historically enabled the growth of repressive forces within the modern state? What evidence is there that U.S.-based entities like the International Republican Institute have undermined democracy in Canada and other countries around the world? What does the harmonization of military and security procedures between Canada and the United States mean for the health of democracy in either country? And what are the prospects for Canada ultimately being able to reclaim its sovereignty from these sinister forces infesting the corridors of power? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we delve into these and other questions with noted poet, author, academic, and former Canadian diplomat, Peter Dale Scott. On today's show, Peter Dale Scott on the Ottawa attacks, continuity of government, and the architecture of the deep state. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 31st, 2014. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The only intelligent and responsible policy is to stop all commercial flights to and from Ebola areas. Health worker volunteers should be transported by military aircraft and should be required to undergo the necessary quarantine before being transported back to the U.S. Why does the White House oppose the only responsible and intelligent policy? The resistance to a sane policy fosters the suspicions that the government or some conspiracy group intends to use Ebola to declare martial law and herd the population or undesirable parts of it into the FEMA camps that Halliburton was paid to construct without the public ever being told the reason for the camps. It is certainly strange that a government involved in long-term wars in the Middle East, the purpose of which is unclear to the public, and in fomenting conflict with both Russia and China, two countries armed with nuclear weapons, would so recklessly create more suspicions among the public of its motives, intentions, and competence. And that is from the article, Martial Law? The Official Ebola Story Doesn't Smell Right, by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted October 29th, originally appearing at paulcraigroberts.org. For many years, I have known that the White House Communications Agency, WHCA, was a factor in the Kennedy assassination because we were given, in conjunction with the Warren Commission investigation of JFK, they released the police transcripts and they released certain Secret Service messages, but it was known there were two channels of the police, both released, but there was also a third channel that was being used in Daly Plaza, and the Secret Service was using the channel of what is called the White House Communications Agency. And in my book, The Road to 9/11, I said the evidence points to suggestion that they were using, they had already implemented COG. Well, that means that if that is the case, they implemented and were using the COG's Special Communications Network, which with change of names is the inheritor of the Emergency Network, and the White House Communications Agency was and still is part of that emergency network. So I could throw in that another deep event was Iran-Contra, and it turned out that Oliver North in 1985-86 was sending arms to Iran, which was illegal, and a lot of people in the government knew nothing about it. They did not know about it because Oliver North was in charge of that same emergency network, and he used that emergency network to make communications with the embassy in Portugal, for example, in order to facilitate getting those arms to Iran. So this to me is one of the most striking common denominators through those big four deep events: JFK, Watergate, Iran-Contra, and finally 9/11. And if we ever have another deep event of this kind, I would predict now, on the basis of past performance, that the emergency network, the one which ordinary people in the government don't have access to, that will be a factor again. That was an excerpt from a conversation between Peter Dale Scott and Lars Schall, transcribed in the article "The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy," posted October 29th, originally appearing at larsschall.com. In his introductory remarks, Lendman called the Ukraine conflict, quote, "the most significant post-WW2 geopolitical crisis," unquote. If Ukraine is to join the European Union, EU, it would have to undergo severe structural economic changes that will be dictated by the EU, the European Central Bank, and the IMF Troika. "This will inevitably affect dramatically the living standards of the population," writes Lendman. He underlines the geostrategic importance of Ukraine with a quotation by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who once said, quote, "Without Ukraine, Russia ceases to be an empire, but with Ukraine suborned and then subordinated, Russia automatically becomes an empire," unquote. That is from the article "Flashpoint in Ukraine: How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III," a review of Stephen Lendman's book by Dr. Ludwig Wiesel, posted October 29th. Since Harper publicly claimed an act of terrorism 2 days before the sensational Ottawa murder and crashing of Parliament, and as soon as the Quebec killing occurred, questions arise. The normally zipper-lip Harper did so long before any forensic facts were in, and before the idea even occurred to anyone else. Revealingly, the federal security state had been running war games exercises depicting just such attacks weeks before the crazed murderers. Lone wolf nutcases, killings out of nowhere, unknown motivators and arming, and the state leader most profiting from the mutation of the demented murders into terrorist acts before anyone else? Who joins the dots? Sure enough, within the day, the RCMP and CSIS get the new extraordinary powers they sought, and for the first time in office, the robotic Harper is behaving with a warmth not even extended to his young son, with whom he shakes hands in farewell. That was from the article "Canada Decoding Harper's Terror Game: Beneath the Masks and Diversions" by Professor John McMurtry, posted October 28th. Clearly, the rise of the so-called Islamic State, or ISIS, did not happen overnight, nor by accident. It was not only the logical result of the United States continuing its strategy of proxy warfare it had carried out against Libya, now unfolding in Syria, it was also the premeditated, documented result of what veteran journalist Seymour Hersh had warned about in 2007. The U.S. has found itself revising history, attempting to explain the existence of ISIS lurking in the footprints of its massive support of so-called moderates in Syria's ongoing conflict. The U.S. has attempted to claim ISIS has built itself on donations, selling oil to the black market, and by taking hostages for ransom. The reality is, to explain how the U.S. and its regional partners have provided moderates with billions in aid only to have ISIS rise up and displace those moderates, we must realize that there were never any moderates to begin with, and that the U.S. intentionally armed and funded terrorists, just as Hersh warned in 2007, to create a terrorist mercenary army that espouses a military vision of Islam and is sympathetic to Al-Qaeda. That was from the article "ISIS, America's Terrorist Mercenaries" by Tony Cartolucci, posted October 28th, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. 1 week ago, Michael Zihaf Bibu opened fire on a soldier and then on security guards just outside the government and opposition caucus rooms in Ottawa. The incident arguably made it easier for the government to secure public support for the passage of enhanced surveillance and police powers, as well as garner support for the campaign against ISIL in the Middle East. What does this incident say about the nature of state power and the characteristics of what's been called deep politics? A well-known writer on the subject of deep politics is Peter Dale Scott. Professor Scott is a Canadian-born poet, a former diplomat, and a former English professor at the University of California, Berkeley. And we're speaking to him from his residence in... We've got him on the line from Berkeley. So thank you very much for joining us on the Global Research News Hour, Professor Scott. Now, first of all, could maybe we should start by getting you to define what a deep political event is. I know you've mentioned in your recent, soon-to-be-released book on the subject, the American Deep State, Wall Street Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. You talk about these sort of deep political events, and I'm wondering what constitutes such an event, and if this attack in Ottawa constitutes such an event.
Yes, well, in a general way, I mean, a good example would be 9/11. It's something that at least those of us who've been living in America, we've had the Kennedy assassination, we had Watergate, we had Iran-Contra, and we've become sort of used to the idea that events are going to happen which are very important, but we're not going to know everything about them. And particularly if there's some kind of subsequent investigation, as there was in both the Kennedy assassination and also 9/11, a commission is set up and they come up with findings, and people start to look at those findings and they see they don't hold up. In the case of the 9/11 commission, even one of the chairmen has said that the CIA wasn't leveling with them, they didn't get to the bottom of it. So a deep event is one of these events that, although it's important, we don't get the whole truth. And when I talk about structural deep events, and everyone I've just mentioned is a structural deep event, it affects the history of the country. Now, your question is about Ottawa. I think this is a deep event because there's some mysterious things. That Mr. Zihaf Bibo, he was not on their list of radicalized, and yet they know everything about him. His name had turned up on the hard drive of somebody who was arrested for terror activities. They didn't put him on the, list. Well, that's kind of mysterious, and it reminds me of Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin of Kennedy. He went very political in the weeks before the Kennedy assassination, and the FBI, who had had him on the watch list, they took him off the watch list. And it's very clear in the case of Oswald, they took him off the watch list so that he would not be under surveillance of the day that Kennedy was in Dallas. And I wonder, and of course I don't have any evidence, but I wonder if Mr. Zihaf was not on their list of radicalized because they didn't want to have him under surveillance the day that he went shooting. The other thing about these deep events is that they're followed by increased secret powers for the deep state, and that does seem to be the case with Mr. Zihaf Bibo, because Harper, Harper gave a speech to Parliament the next day, and he said that, and I'm quoting here from a news account, that authorities need greater power to track, arrest, and detain terror subjects, and this is a quote from his speech, the work that is already underway will be expedited, close quote. And we learned that they were having a series of terrorist war games just before this attack. And I thought the CBC was rather strange when they reported this, because They said, on the one hand, that they've been having these war games, and that they were imagining a case where people came from Syria and attacked in Canada. But this man had never been to Syria. He wanted to go to Syria, but he was mentally deranged. And they had a lockdown of the city. And then again, that suggests to me Boston, where they were hunting for one man, a 19-year-old, and they locked down not only the city of Boston, but cities all around it. A million people were told to stay in their homes to look for one man. And in that case, there was a no-fly zone above, and they canceled two baseball games. It seems incredible overkill to deal with the search. In the case of Ottawa, there wasn't even a search. He was in Parliament building, and they shot him almost immediately. And yet the city remained on lockdown. Why? There was only one person. So I don't know that this yet. I mean, we have to let it become a little more clarified in the course of time. But yes, there a lot of questions need to be asked about what happened in Ottawa. And so at least for the moment, I would say it is a deep event. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, there are certain sorts of, I guess, characteristics of deep events. I mean, one that seems to have come forward is the idea of the quote-unquote lone nut idea, that it's just a rogue individual going off on his own. You mentioned Lee Harvey Oswald, and I guess there's the brothers involved with the Boston bombing. But also there's the alacrity with which the state seems to move in the wake of these events in a very, militarized fashion. There was, I don't know, maybe the one other incident that begins to compare with this that would be in Canadian living memory would be the Black October when the War Measures Act was invoked in the wake of the kidnapping of a Quebec cabinet minister.
The Crise d'Octobre in Quebec, yes. In 1970.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if there's a comparison there that might be instructive in terms of understanding the Canadian context.
This is a bit difficult for me because my father was Frank Scott, and Pierre Trudeau, my father was a constitutional lawyer, and Pierre Trudeau consulted with my father. And I heard a great deal about it subsequently from my father, and I think my father gave bad advice because he counseled Trudeau to bring in the War Measures Act. But I do think that both men were sincere in fearing. You have to remember, again, two men had been kidnapped and one of them had been killed. The scope of what was happening, and also the FLQ had been operating for some time. One way it was not comparable to this thing is that the FLQ had been in the newspapers for a long time, and people were asking Trudeau what he was going to do and so on.
The FLQ were terrorists.
Yes. Well, yes, they killed somebody.
Yes.
And they kidnapped the British consul in Montreal, so it was a matter of high government urgency. So I think it's, for me, I don't count the War Measures Act, the Crise d'Octobre, that was an extreme act of government power, but not to me particularly deep. I think we really do know why Trudeau did it and why my father told him to do it, and even if they were wrong to have done it, it's not particularly mysterious, I think. But here we have an extreme response. I mean, lockdown. How many lockdowns have there been? I only know of the one in Boston, which was incredible overkill. A million people in their homes while they looked for one man who had just escaped on foot out of a car and had no accomplices. He was, at that point, he was on his own. So I think that the analogy, I noticed that more than one person has made the comparison with the Crise d'Octobre, Well, it is comparable in the brutal use of power to bring, you know, it was extreme in 1970. They detained a lot of people without warrants, and they were poets and singers. It was, I think, a colossal mistake. But no, I don't think it was a deep event, because we know why they did it. We just know it was wrong.
Now, in your upcoming book, you talk about these two, I don't know if you call them parallel or opposing forces that seem to be inside these advanced imperial powers. One is democratic persuasion from below, and the other is this sort of suppressive violent force from above. Are we talking, these are just basically latent, as I understand it, latent elements within the state that are opposed to each other? And the one, at least in the case of the United States, we've seen that suppressive power just slowly gaining more and more clout with each passing deep political event.
You know, that distinction, actually, I took from Hannah Arendt in the 1980s, and she was saying that this is true of all societies. In fact, she's quoting Greek authorities from the classical period, and I agree with that. Where I disagree with her was that in the 1980s, she was worried that sort of street elements, popular power, was getting out of hand, and that there needed to be a bit more restraint of it. And there was another man, Samuel Huntington, who had very extreme ideas about there being too much democracy and so on. Whereas what I'm saying in my book is that because of the Cold War and the fear in America of Stalin and what Stalin was doing in Eastern Europe, that the American Constitution, which was set up to ensure that you had very limited government, it created some exceptions to that. The CIA was the obvious one, created in 1947 and given secret powers in 1948. And these were not constitutionally restrained by checks and balances. They were secret powers. And secret power is always unchecked power, and it has grown massively in the half century since the CIA was created. The NSA is even more extreme. It wasn't even created by Congress. It was just created by the president. And here it is, you know, with all these surveillance powers, there's a part of the American Constitution is the right to privacy, but it's just being trampled on by the NSA, and nobody's in the position to do. Congress is not really in the position to do it unless they pass a statute, which they never will because they're too scared of them. So, I think it's time to say that the long course of Western civilization has been a slow but steady ultimate increase in the powers of persuasion against the powers of violence. We don't see many absolutist monarchies anymore. The Soviet Union was pretty extreme, but it is gone. But against that long-term trend, we have seen in America, and now definitely, unfortunately, also in Canada under Harper, an increase in the kind of violent, uncontrolled power from above. And Harper is promising more of it, which really upsets me. He says that they need more power to surveil people. What was wrong with the powers they have already? They seem to have known everything that Mr. Zihab Bibo was doing.
Now, I'm kind of curious about this whole dynamic of these sort of impersonal structures and forces within the state, as opposed to, you know, the idiosyncrasies of an individual political leader, you know, where you hear a lot of chatter about, oh, Harper is this or Bush is that. But at least what I'm seeming to understand from your writings is that there seems to be that that impersonal dynamic is more what we should be focused on. And I'm looking at this WikiLeaks cable you sent me that talks about the National Democratic Institute and the International Republican Institute and their ability to influence renovate political parties in Germany, Spain, and Canada. And that's been successfully carried out. So the sense I got from that was that it's not that Harper is the author of anything. It's almost as if the system has selected, you know, overall is selecting for these sorts of personalities. Is that?
Yes, that's what I believe. And in America, you'll notice that recently, in the old days, we had presidents who got there by being the heads of powerful political machines. FDR was a good president, but that's how he got to be president. Whereas now we have people who are essentially selected by other people, like the young George Bush, who had very few qualifications to be even governor of Texas, but he was picked, and Obama too. He had like 2 years as a couple of years as a senator. He came from nowhere. And in the case of Canada, yes, many Canadians may not know that in the old days the CIA used to pour money into foreign elections, and Congress, right after Watergate, said that was bad and the CIA should not do that. But then Congress created something called the National Democratic Institute and the International Republican Institute to do exactly the same thing, to put money into parties and to help train parties. And there is this cable, which I sent to you, which we know from WikiLeaks, and readers can get from you or me. It's online. You can read it. And it's actually talking about what they're doing in Venezuela against Chavez. They're trying to build up the political parties, and the International Republican Institute builds up right-wing parties, trains them, it has schools for training people how to win elections. And there was $500,000 given to the IRI, the Republican Institute, to do this in Venezuela. And then I'm going to quote from this cable. In addition to the campaign schools, IRI will be bringing in consultants, that's to say from America to Venezuela, who specialize in party renovation to discuss case studies of political parties in Germany, Spain, and Canada, which successfully carried out the process of party renovation, which indicates to me that the IRI had already had a similar process of renovating the Conservative Party in Canada, and so that it isn't a purely Canadian phenomenon, Harper's renovated Conservative Party. It's one which has been given a boost by this IRI, which is a kind of offshoot from what the CIA used to do in the 50s. I've always suspected, for example, that Mike Pearson was defeated and Diefenbaker was elected. I think quite clearly there was a lot of American money that helped elect him, but I suspect that the CIA may have helped back then. But that's pure speculation. Here we have a U.S. government cable saying that the IRI is using what they did in Canada as an example for what they should do in Venezuela. So I think I sent this around to some of my Canadian friends when I ran across it about 8 months ago, and I'm disappointed that no one has yet done anything about this, but I think it's quite important.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. You mentioned the Diefenbaker defeat back, I guess it's a little over 50 years ago. It seems to me that there's been a harmonization of military and security structures over the decades. I mean, we have NORAD and, of course, since 9/11, the creation of the Northern Command. How do you see those that harmonization that of military and security forces affecting the deep politics within Canada?
Yes, well, one of the things that happened, before I get into the NORAD and so on, I'd like to talk about one of the consequences in America after 9/11, which was America had up until then what they called Posse Comitatus Acts, which with a memory of what happened after the Civil War in the South, where the army essentially governed the southern states for many years until there was a deal that this would stop. And then they passed these Posse Comitatus Acts, which said that the army will not, except on an emergency basis, be involved in security. Well, that ended with 9/11. And they created this NORTHCOM, it's a Northern Command in the United States in 2002. And, of course, now we'll come to the fact of NORAD. And here again, I was a personal witness. I was in External Affairs, in Ottawa when, Diefenbaker was elected and, Defense Department went to Diefenbaker and said, oh, we have this agreement. We want you to sign it. Well, it should have come through External Affairs because it affected the foreign relations of Canada. And it didn't. And it was kind of a scam, really. And Diefenbaker signed it without knowing what he was doing. And that's all history now because it's been resumed again. But I think that there were a lot of anyway, it gave a lot of power to NORAD Command, which is in Colorado, to govern what happens in Canada. Now, since 9/11, we have the Americans created NORTHCOM to deal with putting the army in a regular position of collaboration with the police and so on. They have what they call fusion centers, where everybody's surveilling us now. Private companies are surveilling us. The army is surveilling us. And this is now legal in America. Well, I don't know how many Canadians know this, but there was a Canada command set up in 2006 to do essentially in Canada what NORTHCOM is doing in America. And then in 2008, there was an agreement signed in Texas, of all places, not between the Prime Minister of Canada and the President of the United States, but between the commander of NORAD and NORTHCOM, General Renouard, and the Canadian Air Force, General Marc Gimet, and they signed what they called a civil assistance plan, and I'm quoting from their own press release, that allows the military from one nation to support the armed forces of the other nation during a civilian emergency. And again, I think this is, I'm going to quote more from there. This is what NORTHCOM and Canada Command said in their joint press release back in 2008. This document is a unique bilateral military plan to align our respective national military plans to respond quickly to the other nation's requests for military support of civil authorities. Unity of effort during bilateral support for civil support operations such as floods, Well, that's reasonable. Forest fires, okay. Hurricanes, earthquakes, and effects of a terrorist attack. Well, that means that if they feel there's a terrorist attack in Canada, then the U.S., the Canadian Army, not the Canadian Prime Minister, the Canadian Army can ask the American Army to come in and help deal with the consequences of it. And I don't know how much publicity this got in Canada, but I think that was a very distinct infringement on Canadian sovereignty. And I understand, you know, going back to NORAD, I understand that there was the need for something. If you, in an age when missiles can come from Russia or China over the pole, they have to be intercepted as quickly as possible. And that's why we had a dew line in the north of Canada, and that's why eventually we had NORAD. It's the details of NORAD that upset me, and it's the details of this agreement between NORTHCOM and CanadaCOM for the armies to help each other. I think that, the civilians are supposed to control these armies, and I'm upset about that.
Professor Scott, I was wondering if you could comment on in past deep events, if when you have individuals like a Paul Wellstone or people who may have been sort of obstacles to the successful execution of legislation, you know, putting out sort of inconvenient messaging, the whole idea of putting a chill on politicians or media representatives who are, you know, who are not cooperating with the that agenda. Do you have any, based on what we've seen in the past, can you project what we might see in here in Canada in terms of people who are not necessarily going along with the plan to protect ourselves from these terrorists?
Well, I don't think, I mean, I have followed what happened to Senator Wellstone, but I've never written about it because I feel I don't have enough evidence to voice an opinion, and so I'll stay with that now. But I can, in a more general way, assure you that in America there have been many people who've stood up to particularly getting involved in foreign wars. You know, the Tonkin Gulf, the Vietnam War was, if it was authorized at all, it was authorized by Congress by what we call the Tonkin Gulf Resolution in 1964. And that was in response to a false story that two American destroyers had been attacked in the Tonkin Gulf. It wasn't true. And actually, the deep state, as I call it, the National Security Agency, knew it wasn't true, but they suppressed the evidence that it wasn't true, and they let, and the CIA did the same thing, and that's what I mean about the deep state controlling the public state, by, in this case, by suppressing evidence. So Congress was given an ultimatum. We've got this attack, we have to pass a response to it. And a very broadly worded resolution was passed in response. Two senators opposed it, and this is why I'm bringing this up. Both those senators were defeated when they stood up for re-election. And in the case of Iran-Contra, there was a congressman again, Michael Barnes, who said that we shouldn't be giving all this aid to the Contras down in Nicaragua, and they was successful in passing a series of amendments limiting this. Well, in that case, Oliver North in the White House directed public funds into a program that they set up in the State Department using an ex-CIA person to head it, and they directed public funds to defeat Michael Barnes when he stood for re-election, and they did defeat him. And I've written about this many times, and I could extend that list. It's a very alarming list. I think the biggest example would be President Carter, who tried to cut back on the CIA And the elements in the CIA and the big oil companies, I do talk about this in my book, The American Deep State, that will be out in a couple of weeks, that conspired, and that is the word, I think, to make sure that he would not be reelected, and he wasn't. And we got the Reagan Revolution, and a lot of new things began with Reagan, of which continuity of government planning to deal with any crisis. This is a very big subject, but it's an important one. And yes, the world has really changed since 9/11 for Canada as well as America. But if there was a moment when it was a crucial change, I would say it was when Reagan was elected, and he changed some aspects of what the deep state has been doing, with major consequences, like the involvement of the military with the police and surveillance.
Mm. Now, yeah, I think I recall reading about that. Essentially, there were some precautions that needed to be taken in the wake of a nuclear attack. And suddenly, like over time, they just moved in a stealth-like way to have these sorts of mechanisms invoked, not just in the case of a nuclear attack where you're giving more power to the executive, but to, you know, anything that could be construed as an emergency, whether it is a hurricane or what have you.
Exactly right. Yes, the COG, continuity of government, referred originally to dealing with the crisis if, say, an atom bomb hit Washington and the government was decapitated. The president was dead, the vice president, the heads of Congress. The Constitution would not work in that situation, so they had people planning what they called COG, continuity of government procedures. Well, with the election of Reagan in 1980, those changed into what I call COG, change of government procedures, because the plans essentially called for suspension of the Constitution. And by the way, I'll give a couple of details which are in the headlines these days. Warrantless surveillance, warrantless detention, and then martial law. It was originally, but now it's just the militarization of Homeland Security. And all of this started almost immediately and was planned by a secret committee that was set up under Reagan. And interestingly, two of the people on that secret committee were Donald Rumsfeld, who at the time was not in the government. He was the head of a corporation. And Dick Cheney, who at the time was a congressman from Wyoming. Eventually, the two of them were both heads of corporations, not in the government, but they continued, even under Clinton, to be planning for the suspension of the Constitution. And then, of course, when Bush, he was elected. He was elected by a vote of 5-4 in the Supreme Court in 2000, and Rumsfeld became defense secretary, Cheney became the vice president, and on 9/11 they implemented these new COG plans. Oh, I forgot to mention that Reagan, before he left office, he issued an executive order saying that COG would apply to any emergency, and of course 9/11 was an emergency, so they actually implemented COG. These plans for the suspension of the Constitution, we don't know what they really are except for the three features I gave to you. And that was done on 9/11. And Obama, to his discredit, continues to extend a state of emergency in which some of these measures continue to apply. So this is a very major change to the status of the public state in America, because it is now, the Constitution is in effect being overridden with respect to habeas corpus, being overridden with respect to the right to privacy, by secret rules that we haven't even seen.
So the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about half a century ago is essentially overwhelmed this organism that is the United States and apparently Canadian society. What is there any realistic way of putting that force back in its bottle? Fighting back, as it were, resisting, so that that democratic persuasion from below becomes the more dominant force?
Well, I don't know that the CSIS is as powerful in Canada as the CIA is in America. I have a sort of feeling that it might be easier to do that, put the genie back in the bottle, to do it in Canada, because for one thing, Canada is a more coherent society, and people have closer contacts, I think, with their MPs. Even when I was a student, I got a question asked in Parliament, and so that democracy should, I think, function better in Canada, because there's not as much money corrupting it in Canada, I think. You could say, on the other hand, that Canada's now become so dependent on America that we'd have to put the genie back in the bottle in America first. And that's going to be very, very difficult indeed. But I think that all Canadians should be on their guard against American encroachment on Canadian sovereignty. And, there still is a constitution, and it should just insist that it's not being overridden by secret rules like COG.
It does seem to me that there's a lot of sophistication in the instruments that can be brought to bear, and I'm thinking particularly about media, because you just look at the last that election campaign in which Stephen Harper got elected, in which the RCMP seemed to have helped them by inflating the case against the Liberals and Ralph Goodale in particular, in terms of the suspicion
exactly.
of.
And that has an American precedent, because I don't want to say that the FBI invented Ronald Reagan, but they certainly gave him a lot of help by disseminating false information. And when he became governor of California, he rode into power on the basis of a lot of false information about what was happening at my university at Berkeley. We had a free speech movement, and Hoover was saying it was communist controlled, and then Reagan picked that up and campaigned and got himself elected. He didn't run against the Democratic opponent, Pat Brown. He ran against my university, and he won, thanks to false information supplied by the FBI. So I think that the campaign, was done with Goodale, was following an American precedent there.
Mm. Canadians are typically used to influencing their overseers through elections. You don't like what this prime minister is doing, you vote in a different one. But I've come to see elections as very much not so much an exercise of which of these parties has the policies that are most in my or our interest. It's more who has the best campaign, who is better capable of manipulating the public into voting for them. And it's so sophisticated with polling and focus groups and just, sophisticated
right.
psychology.
I think that's where the IRI, this American Institute, probably was of great aid to Harper. The Tories were not famous for being sophisticated, and then suddenly Stephen Harper has a very sophisticated campaign. I think that there may have been some American help there. But, Canadian politics are quite fluid. Look at the way the Liberal Party vanished in the last elections, and that's hopeful. If a Liberal Party can vanish, then maybe the Conservative Party can vanish. It means that whereas in America, we're in a much more, I think, ossified situation. Both parties are being funded by the same big interests, and I don't think you could expect the kind of surprises in America that we saw in the last Canadian election. So that's why I'm hopeful about Canada, but only if Canadians will think for themselves and make considered decisions before they vote.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it seems to me, though, like, I guess what I could imagine happening is Harper could very easily vanish and then we get replaced with another party in power, whether it's the Liberals or the NDP, and they faced with the reality of power and American influence through a harmonized military and trade and other mechanisms, they may just have to throw their hands up in the air and say, well, we'd like to follow through with our campaign commitments, but this is the reality we have to deal with. We are not really sovereign. I guess.
Yes, I understand what you're saying, and I think most Canadians know, whether they've been in government as I have or not, that yes, the United States is a reality that all Canadians have to deal with. The problem is that right now, what is happening now is extreme, and I would say un-Canadian, and a lot of really rather sacred Canadian principles and, you know, welfare and so on is being ridden roughshod over. So you'll never eliminate the American presence, but Canada was under Trudeau, for example. Trudeau had to deal with the same problem, and Canada, I think, was, except for the War Measures Act, I think Canada had some very good years under Trudeau, and it should have very good years under somebody again.
The book that you've just written and is coming out in a couple of weeks, The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. Would you like to just maybe introduce that to our audiences and maybe give us some indication of just how, I mean, whatever the case might be in Canada, is the United States damaged beyond repair or is there hope down there?
Yes, well, I don't think it's damaged beyond repair. If I did, I wouldn't have written the book. I often listen to, I go to conferences where there's usually somebody will get up and say, now we're living under fascism. And I say, no, if we were living under fascism, we wouldn't be meeting at this conference. So, but what I am very concerned about, and of course I'm not alone here, is that many people, the word deep state is being used quite a lot in America now because we've become aware that there are, in a sense, two levels of government. There is the level which is authorized by the U.S. Constitution, and then the genie you were talking about that got out of the bottle, we've created institutions like the CIA and the NSA, which are not under secure control of those constitutions. The CIA, for example, has, from the very beginning, had access to funds which were not voted by Congress. So it's not completely controlled. It's not controlled at all, really, by Congress. It's more like Congress is controlled by the CIA. That's the problem. And I'm saying that behind the reason this has happened, I mean, why would something like the CIA get all this power? And I say that behind both the public government and institutions like the CIA is the presence of great wealth in America, is symbolized by Wall Street. And a lot of people don't know that Truman didn't want to have a CIA, and he initially took steps to block it. And then Alan Dulles he was in New York at the time, and a group of lawyers, they essentially told him, no, you have to have a CIA, and they gave him a plan, which then Congress duly ratified, and in the end, Alan Dulles joined the CIA and headed the organization which he had planned when he was back in Wall Street. Well, Alan Dulles' law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell, happened to be the law firm that represented the big oil companies, the big oil cartels. And they were a cartel in those days, clearly. And so that Wall Street has been able to impose its will. I quote from President Roosevelt, FDR in 33, and he knew all of this from the inside. And he said, really, that those Wall Street presence has been running the country since the days of Andrew Jackson. Well, that's the problem. But it doesn't mean that everything's hopeless, because America is essentially, I mean, if you leave out everything that's happened since 1980, America was moving in a progressive direction. Disparity of wealth and income, which is a major factor in what we're talking about, and I keep coming back to it in my book, that disparity of wealth and income was being reduced in America right up until 1980, when Reagan was elected, and since then we've had a massive move in the other direction. It's like what they call the Gilded Age of America back in the 1880s, a time of huge corruption and huge disparity. And the problem is, I don't want to paint too gloomy a picture of it, because I feel that, you know, government will always be imperfect, and American government will certainly always be imperfect, but it was on a much healthier path until we had this massive increase in secret power that done largely through COG that has happened since 1980. So that's the core of my book. And what it means for Canada is that you should watch very carefully institutions like the CSIS. I threw my little voice in, essentially trying to check the powers that were being given to the CSIS. Not that my voice was heard by anybody, but the RCMP is, you know, they do good things. We need an RCMP. But they used to tap my father's phone, and they were doing things like that J. Edgar Hoover did in America. They need to be watched, and they need to be controlled. And I think right now, Canada, it's just my personal opinion, needs a change of government, because Harper is leading Canada away from its usual course of politics, and that needs to be checked.
Well, Professor Scott, I think we're just about out of time, but I really wanted to thank you for this conversation. I've been wanting to have you on the program for a long time now, and I was grateful for the opportunity to have this conversation, and I hope it won't be our last. Thank you very much for your comments on the...
Thank you. I enjoyed the questions.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Professor Peter Dale Scott is a poet, former Canadian diplomat, and a former English professor at the University of California, Berkeley. His upcoming book, The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy, will be released November 12th. For more on Peter Dale Scott's writings, his ideas, and his new book, check out his website, peterdalescott.net. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.